Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Hello, I am Kimberly Adams, and welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, which means we're doing a deep dive. Yes, I said it, into a single topic. Today, it is the metaverse. As you know, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, last week we had Neal Stephenson on, who coined the term metaverse back in 1992 in a book called Snow Crash. It is, as he described it, a 3D virtual world where people interact through avatars.
Which is not exactly what we have today, even though the term is being thrown around a lot by a lot of tech companies and gaming companies who say that they are building the real metaverse. You probably noticed Facebook even changed its name to Meta and really have doubled down on this concept. But we wanted to kind of get into how real this actually is and what it means for our real lives and our virtual lives. Is this really the beginning of sort of the next stage of the internet or, you know, a real life science fiction movie? Who knows?
Here to make us smart is Eric Ravenscraft. He's a product writer, also a reviewer at Wired. Eric, thanks for coming on the pod.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So look, how real is this metaverse? Could we have like a definition of what we're talking about so we can all understand here, please?
Well, it's complicated because the definition of what the metaverse is really depends on who you're asking. If you ask Facebook, now Meta, it's a social network where you're going to wear VR headsets all the time. If you ask Microsoft, it's more of a productivity suite where you'll have virtual meetings using augmented reality headsets. And those definitions kind of depend on what that particular company pitching this vision of the metaverse is selling. The conceptual idea is a shared 3D world that uses VR and AR and has tens of thousands of people, and it's all interoperable. But right now, I would actually say that the best definition of the metaverse, the phrase the metaverse, is that it's kind of a catch-all marketing term that a lot of different companies are using to convey the value they see in their potential future products.
I want to emphasize something you just said because it sort of gets at the difference between how the metaverse is often talked about in science fiction or even, you know, in all these different representations versus what we have now, which is that shared part and that interoperability, this idea that you can take your virtual identity across platforms, which you really can't do right now.
You can't to a certain extent. Like, there are little bits of it. Like, you can take a profile picture from one platform to another by copying a JPEG from one site to another. That's kind of interoperability, but that's not what they're really talking about when tech companies pitch interoperability. The comparison they usually make is it's like when the internet was new, or when we invented the web. Those were interoperable technologies. Those were built on things like the network protocol stack, the TCP/IP stack for the internet, and things like HTTP and HTML for the web that allowed websites to talk to other websites, that allowed computers to talk to other computers. But right now, there's not a comparable, like, single underlying technology behind the metaverse. So what you end up having are just separate VR or AR applications that are neat on their own, like they're great, but they're still just separate devices and separate apps right now.
And can you break down you know, maybe where you see this going. Like, is there any sense that we're going to head in the direction of getting sort of a single organizing platform?
I would actually say there are two challenges to a massive interoperable metaverse. The first is a technical problem that requires a huge scale. So, for example, right now, we've seen concerts happen in video games like Fortnite or applications that are specifically for developing concerts. And what you'll usually see a few dozen or 100 people show up in a concert, and that's it. Which is, you know, that's not Queen playing at Wembley Stadium. That's your buddy in the back room of a bar, right? Like, that's not really that big of a concert. What you would need to see, you know, a really massive scale virtual world like that is tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people in the same space. And that is an engineering problem that is very difficult to tackle. Intel recently came out and said, you know, they envision that it will take 1,000 times more computing power than we have today in order to host some of the virtual worlds that might occupy a theoretical metaverse. And then they said that over the next, I think they said 5 years or so, we might see 10 times as much processing power. Like, the people selling processing power said, I don't know if we're going to have that much anytime soon. And that's just one challenge.
Yeah. Once you get past the scale problem, though, Eric, right, is this a little bit of the VHS Betamax debate of the 70s, right, where, you know, you couldn't put a Betamax tape in a VHS machine. And we have now here whatever Zuckerberg's going to do, and I'm sure the Acme Metaverse company is going to come up with its own thing, and we're going to have competing technologies that aren't necessarily going to be able to talk to each other.
Right. And I would say it's so much worse than VHS versus Betamax because, you know, imagine that. But if there were 100 different VHS, like 100 different formats that you could buy, and you have to buy the hardware for them or you have to buy the software for them. And the trouble isn't that you can't make these technologies interoperable. It's that the companies that make them are very often motivated against making them interoperable. So, for example, if Facebook makes a big social network where you can, you know, buy virtual clothes and different avatars and build your own virtual house, that's locking users into their system. What motivation do they have to let you take all of those assets, the house, the avatar, the clothes, and export them to whatever Microsoft makes or Blizzard or Epic Games? This is sort of what I call the iMessage problem. You know, nothing is stopping Apple from putting iMessage on Android phones, except that Apple will sell fewer iPhones if they do that. So there's a huge motivation for companies that develop VR and AR applications to lock users in. And then on top of that, companies or even just individual users that generate the content you see in these worlds. So, for example, World of Warcraft is arguably already a virtual metaverse-type world. You can hop in this game world, you can buy and sell things, you can meet other people, you could socialize, you could meet someone, you could fall in love, you could get married in World of Warcraft. But Blizzard doesn't have the financial motivation to let you take your avatar from World of Warcraft and transport it to Fortnite or to any other game. You know, that's Blizzard's intellectual property. So it's not just a technical problem. It's a financial and a motivational problem.
And this is why my gaming days kind of ended with RuneScape, because I couldn't take that stuff anywhere. Sorry, that's a real old game.
I relate to that. I've got a lot of assets tied up in World of Warcraft, but I'm never going to be able to take them anywhere.
This kind of sort of profit motivation, does that explain why we're hearing so much hype about the metaverse right now, just that these companies are trying to get ahead of it and lead the pack on this?
I would say yes to, like, in a couple of branching directions as well. So to a certain extent, the tech industry as a whole relies on futurism. The pitch of a future world where we're going to build this amazing new technology and whatever new technology happens to be at the time. You know, a couple of years ago, it was 5G. You know, 5G is going to come out and it's going to make your phone into a faster internet device than your home internet. And that's going to enable smart cities and fleets of cars that all talk to each other. And it turns out it's, you know, your phone's faster. That's about all that's happened really on that front. So there's always some big topic that is used to pitch the future. And right now it's just the metaverse's turn. So when Facebook wants to sell VR headsets or Microsoft wants to court developers for their augmented reality platform, you know, saying you can make an app for this VR headset that maybe 10 million people have is kind of interesting, but you can make the app for the metaverse, which is the future of the internet, is a much more engaging and persuasive pitch, even if it's a bit more, you know, future vision-y and less practical.
So you've seen Ready Player One, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. I've seen Ready Player One.
Yeah. Okay. Great movie. Takes place almost entirely in what I imagine is that film's portrayal of the metaverse. But without any real spoilers, for those who haven't seen it, first of all, go see it. But look, there is one big giant company that controls this whole freaking thing, which is where everybody freaking lives. Tell me why that's not what we're looking at.
Well, I mean, the good news is, practically speaking, it seems unlikely that one specific company would dominate everything. Like, even right now, Facebook is dominant in the social media space, but there are still other players. But it's a little funny that you point that out, because that's sort of, it's sort of the, I don't know if you've seen, there's a great tweet that went around about, like, you know, we've invented the torment nexus from the famous novel, Don't Invent the Torment Nexus.
That's great.
Yeah. That's sort of the pitch we're seeing is, you know, the point, like, part of the point of Ready Player One was, you know, this one big company controls this thing and they want to control even more of it. And they're going to stick ads, and like the villain is the guy running it.
Right.
And then tech CEOs come out and go, yeah, that thing, we're doing that thing. And
exactly.
like we are the villains, yes.
right. And like one of the biggest responses I've seen is, you know, if there was going to be a virtual world where, like, you can go shop and interact and socialize and everything you do in this virtual world goes to this one big platform, Facebook isn't the company I want controlling that.
Yeah.
That's not just me saying this. Like, I've seen that response when I write articles about that. Like, every comment thread, every, you know, criticism I've seen says something like just specifically about Facebook, about Meta. You know, like, is that the company that you want to control this? So I don't know that there's much demand for that. But then there's also other smaller companies who can sort of, the way we talk about the metaverse as though it's a singular entity and it's inevitable, gives room for a lot of smaller companies to say, well, we're doing that too. We're building the metaverse. And that gives more legitimacy to other players who may not have the same reputation as Facebook, but might have just as much of a motivation to use or possibly abuse data or virtual surveillance of their users as well.
Yeah. All right. One more, and then we'll let you get on about your day. And here's the question.
Oh,
so a number of years ago, I did a segment on Marketplace that had me wearing a VR headset. And granted, this was not the latest generation, but it was a while ago. And I had to be in the thing for like half an hour. And when I got out, there was like a migraine coming on and my eyes were crossing and there was a little bit of vertigo. It was not a pleasant experience. And what's the physical experience going to be like? I'm not going to have something on my head and like arm controllers and stuff.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. Right before I came on here, Facebook released I came across a Facebook ad for another of their metaverse properties. And it's one of the few ads you see where they actually show the person in real life using it. I mean, it's all simulated, but you see a person standing in the living room with a headset on. And on the other side of the room, their spouse is like looking at them going, what are you doing?
Right.
Like, and they're talking about, you know, you're going to paint and you're going to create stuff in this world. But what they're showing is someone standing, first off, in a big room, like a living room type space with a headset strapped to their face. And they're waving their arms around. Like, this just isn't how people want to interact with computers on a day-to-day basis. And I don't think, it's not impossible for engineers to solve this problem. Like, maybe someday there will be AR glasses that are just as light as regular glasses, but they have a display in them or something. Maybe that will happen, but that's not what they're selling right now. And it's a big difference between the simulated versions of the world right. that they show in fictional advertisements and what we actually have today.
Exactly. Exactly. Eric Ravenscraft, he's a product writer, also a reviewer at Wired, walking us through the metaverse, which is coming to an internet sometime soon near you, I'm sure. Eric, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was with...
What are you talking about, Kai? People say it's already here.
Yeah, well, it is already here. I'll tell you, though. So it was with Ben Johnson, who longtime mm-hmm. Marketplace listeners will remember that name. And we yes. did a thing. He was in one room. I was in the other room. And we did this virtual meeting, blah, blah, blah. And it was terrible. It was terrible. So, you know, we'll see what the technology does, you know?
I got a VR headset because my mother wanted one.
Oh, yeah.
And she wanted someone to do it with her.
Right.
And help her walk through it. And we were doing this roller coaster game and both got so nauseous.
Yes. That's what
but,
I'm saying.
You know, on the other hand, one of my friends, her husband uses a VR headset to, like, model out his sort of craft projects before he yeah. does them and yeah. using, like, equipment that he wouldn't have access
right.
to otherwise.
Right.
And
right.
so, you know, people are doing stuff.
Totally are. Totally are. So listen, let us know what you think. If there is a version of the metaverse that you think you might be interested in, let us know. Our number is 508-827-6278, 508-82-SMART, or leave us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll get you on the show, and we'll also be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Okay, time for the news fix. You want to go first, Kai?
I will go first. So there's a report out today from the Department of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, Secretary, saying that in 2019, American companies had, on average, 40 days worth of supply of semiconductors. And here now, 2 years into this pandemic, they are down to 5 days worth of supply. And you might think, okay, so they've got 5 days worth of supply of chips on the shelves. This survey looked at 160 different kinds of semiconductors. So everything from what goes in your fridge to your car to your computers to you name it, we're down to a 5-day supply, which if you're in manufacturing means fundamentally nothing. And I would just like to suggest that we are a long, long way, despite the Intel announcement from last week that they're going to build a $20 billion plant in Columbus, Ohio. We are a long way from the chip shortage being solved. And the chip shortage, of course, is driving a lot of the car prices, which is driving inflation. And I could go on, but I won't. So I thought that was newsworthy.
That Intel plant's going to take what, like a decade to get fully up and running?
I think it's going to be up and running by 2025, but then from there it takes years to get the chips out. So, you know.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Not great.
It's
not great, Bob.
You know, I've had this conversation with a lot of friends lately about just this, the fact that here in the United States, we're having the experience that many folks in the rest of the world do on a regular basis, which is just moving away from this assumption that everything is always available.
Yeah.
Like, you and I have lived outside the country, and sometimes you can get certain things and sometimes you can't. It's just stuff isn't always available, but that's a new feeling to a lot of people here.
Yep, so. Totally.
Speaking of stuff that isn't available.
Nicely done.
I actually am putting in a story that David Brancaccio and I did this morning in for my news fix, which is this report out from another executive agency, oddly enough, the Department of Labor, along with HHS, which is on mental health parity. And this idea that if you have an insurance plan that offers mental health care, it is supposed to offer those mental health and substance use disorder services at the same level and to the same extent that they offer physical health care. And this is a law that has been on the books since like 2008. And over again, there's just reams of evidence and lawsuits and complaints that that's just not the case. And anybody who has ever tried to get mental health care has probably some kind of story about how much harder it is than getting physical health care if you like break your arm or something like that. So the Department of Labor has been going out to these insurance plans and asking them to provide information about how they're living up to their parity obligations. And nobody who responded gave them sufficient answers. Zero. None of them. And so then there was all these series of letters and things like that, and some insurance companies fixed stuff. But what this report reveals is like some really concrete examples of what this looks like. It's people who are trying to get treatment for their kids with autism who are denied certain kinds of therapy, people with eating disorders being told that the insurance won't cover nutritional counseling, people with substance use disorders being told that their prescriptions to deal with their addictions are not covered, or, you know, someone with a speech impediment not getting their speech therapy covered, which are things that under the law are supposed to be done. And it's astonishing how widespread these violations are so long after this law was passed. And there's really not a lot that people can do about it. Like, sure, if you can prove it, you can file a lawsuit, and then the Department of Labor has all these benefits managers you can call and ask for help to kind of walk you through whether or not this bad thing that happened to you really is a parity violation. But the DOL doesn't have any authority to fine the insurance plans that are in violation or even to sort of help consumers get restitution if they paid out of pocket for stuff they weren't supposed to. So it's an extraordinarily wonky report, but it's very interesting to me.
Yeah. And it's a big deal, right? Because as we know, mental health and physical health are one in the damn same.
Yes, they are.
All right. That's the news. Let us do the mail.
Hi, Make Me Smart team.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Okay, last Friday, Kai, I did the thing that I was joking about doing in the meeting that we were in last week.
All right.
Which is, which is that Andy and I talked about West Elm Caleb.
Oh, wow.
Which is the story about a guy in New York who allegedly ghosted several women and did all these other bad behaviors that the women he allegedly dated did not like. And this whole saga was played out on TikTok and on Twitter. But it's also raising questions about online privacy. And so I asked everyone to send in their thoughts on this, and we got this voice memo.
Hi, this is Di from Los Angeles. I was listening to Kimberly's struggle over the West Elm Caleb thing. And what really struck me, what kept coming to mind again and again, was this quote from Anne Lamott, and I'm probably going to slaughter it, but essentially it's like, tell your story. If people wanted you to tell better stories, they should have behaved better. And if people are telling their story and you didn't behave well, that's kind of on you. And that's my take.
That's a good take.
Yes, but At what level do those stories get amplified on the global scale?
Well, yeah, that's a fair point. Fair point.
Like, look, I date. I have had bad experiences, and like, I definitely complain to my girlfriends about them.
Yeah, but you don't put them online.
I don't put them online, and I don't. But then at the same time, you know, many of these women probably did not have the expectation that it was going to get as big as it did. So I mean, like, yeah. I don't want to like put an undue burden on them for the fact that it went viral.
Right.
Like, but the internet is everywhere. So.
It is everywhere and it is forever. All right. We talked about the phrase deep dive a couple of times. I believe I said it at the top of the program today and how it's overused maybe sometimes. Kevin out of Charlotte, North Carolina says this, just a thought for your Tuesday episodes. While deep dive may no longer be fashionable, I posit that deeper dive is an appropriate alternative. It retains the intent of the original nickname while accurately describing the episode, a deeper dive into a topic than you can normally take. I don't hate that. I don't hate that at all.
I don't hate it.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Maybe we'll say deeper dive.
Maybe. Okay.
So we are going to leave you, as we always do, with today's answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? This week's answer comes to us from...
This is Aaron from Muncie, Indiana.
Hi, Aaron.
Where Bob Ross used to paint his happy little trees.
Oh, wow.
One thing I thought I knew that I later found out I was wrong about is that bald eagles make this noise.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, my friends, that majestic screech is from the red-tailed hawk. Bald eagles actually make this noise.
Really? That sounds so small bird-like.
It's really squeaky.
I'm completely unimpressed.
Television and Hollywood have been selling us a tale for decades, but now you know the truth, and you know that Bridget Bodner was right.
Well, Bridget's always right because she's the boss.
That's the default.
So, you know, Bridget's always right. I ain't no dope. I did not know that about eagles and red-tailed hawks. That is fascinating. Had no idea.
I occasionally see bald eagles flying around in my neighborhood in Washington,
D.C. Do you really?
Yeah. Yeah. There's some that, like, live in this part of the area. But, like, I'm sure with all the construction, they will never come back.
No.
Anywho.
Not. All right. Yeah. The takeaway from that is that Bridget Bodner is right. So there you go.
Always.
Send us your answers. Well, if you have more than one answer to the Make Me Smart question, send us that too. Anyway, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Leave us a voice message at our new phone number, 508-82-SMART, or you can shoot us an email, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Both are fine with us.
When is it no longer new?
I don't know. How long has it been? Has it been a year yet?
I don't know. Anyway, we're done for today.
Yeah.
Megan and Marielle will be answering your questions tomorrow for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. So if you have questions for them, don't forget to send those over too.
Sorry, just waiting. Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Marquette Green. Tony Wagner this week hands off newsletter writing duties to Ellen Rolfes. Thank you, Tony, for all your good service to this podcast. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe with mixing by Brian Allison. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed this very bouncy theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. It is so bouncy.
It is very bouncy. That's a good word.
I kind of like bounce to it every time.
It's a very good word.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.